despite the difference of interests at the table, there's a collective interest in doing, you know, good stewardship of the land as it benefits communities.
Stakeholders meet to shape the future of the Tongass. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new research sheds light on the expanding range of the red fox in Alaska.
I mean, the Arctic fox picture is like a little Prius, and the red fox picture is a big old Cadillac. It just needs more fuel to get by.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
BP Alaska, a major player in the state's oil industry, is planning to lay off 275 employees and contractors early next year. Spokeswoman Dawn Patience says the business in Alaska will be smaller due to the previously announced sales of interests in four North Slope oil fields to Hillcorp. Patience says the layoffs, combined with the 200 individuals who have accepted jobs with Hillcorp, represents about 17% of the total number of BP employees and contractors in the state.
We've told our employees that our operational footprint was shrinking. Our business is smaller here in Alaska.
The company's regional president, in announcing the sale in April, said it would allow for BP to focus on maximizing production from Prudhoe Bay and advancing plans for a major liquefied natural gas project. BP only informed Hillcorp today that they planned additional layoffs. Lori Nelson, who manages Hillcorp's external affairs, says she's not sure why BP is associating that decision with the sale. When the sale was made in April, only 250 employees were associated with those assets, and Hillcorp agreed to absorb most of them.
The number today is a bit of a surprise, but that's BP's decision.
The layoff announcement comes less than a month after Alaskans narrowly voted to keep a cap on the oil production tax rate. BP was a top contributor to the campaign against the oil referendum, spending $3 million to fight it. In a press release, Governor Sean Parnell also called the announcement extremely disappointing. The state of Alaska filed motions in federal court today to participate in lawsuits that seek to halt or delay the U.S. Forest Service's planned Big Thorn timber sale on Prince of Wales Island. The state's action is meant to, quote, protect the state, its political subdivisions, and its citizens against the monetary and socioeconomic impacts of interference with timber supply in southeast Alaska. The state asks for the right to participate at least as an amicus or a friend of the court. The final decision to move forward with the Big Thorn project was announced in late August, and five conservation groups immediately filed lawsuits protesting that decision. The proposed timber harvest would include about 6,000 acres of old-growth rainforest. Environmental organizations say that acreage is critical habitat for deer and wolf populations. A three-day meeting in Juneau between stakeholders in the Tongass National Forest wrapped up on Friday. It's the second in a series that the Tongass Advisory Committee has leading up to its May deadline to produce its recommendations. Representatives of the U.S. Forest Service, the timber industry, state government, local communities, tribal entities, and conservationists on the committee are trying to work out policies that will let them all sustainably coexist. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
For 3 days, a few dozen people hold up in a Travelodge conference room in Juneau. There's coffee and donuts, PowerPoint presentations, and an easel with big sheets of scratch paper. The mutually shared mantra among the Tongass Advisory Committee members is what they're calling the triple bottom line: ecological, social, and economic sustainability in the Tongass National Forest. One of their directives from U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack is to transition the timber industry to harvesting only the Tongass's young growth. That is, trees that have grown back in areas previously logged or disturbed.
It is going to be a huge challenge to make a financially viable industry with 200,000 acres of young growth on a 17-million acre forest.
That's Tongass Advisory Committee member Eric Nichols. He's part owner of Ketchikan's Alcan Forest Products Incorporated and Evergreen Timber.
the land-based, it's going to be a huge impact in that you've got to have the land-based to grow the trees. And the more we shrink this land-based, the higher probability of failure you have.
If the committee is successful and the Forest Service adopts its policy recommendations, it should head off the kind of legal wrangling that the community of Thorn Bay is on the sidelines of now. Thorn Bay is a community of about 500 on Prince of Wales Island. It's part of a census area that consistently has the highest unemployment rates in Southeast Alaska. Its economy used to be dominated by the timber industry. Nowadays, Wayne Benner says it's down to
about a half a dozen small little working mills, ma and pa mills.
Benner is the advisory committee's co-chair and Thorn Bay city administrator.
Definitely want to make sure that they continue on and have the ability to survive and prosper. And at the same time, all the other uses of the Tongass National Forest are preserved so that the other entities, the lodges, people coming to hunt and coming to fish also have the opportunity to enjoy them.
Benner says his government hasn't formally taken a position on the Forest Service's controversial Big Thorn timber sale, which could be a boon to the local economy, but destroy thousands of acres of old-growth forest. The timber sale may not be ecologically or economically sustainable, according to Earth Justice and the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. They're part of a coalition of conservation groups fighting the timber sale in court. Back at the Travel Lodge, community interests are getting a lot of attention, says Jason Anderson, deputy forest supervisor for the Tongass.
Despite the difference of interests at the table, there's a collective interest in doing, you know, good stewardship of the land as it benefits communities. There's probably some difference of opinion about how that's going to look, but the value of having them all at the table and hashing all that out is really, the, in my opinion, the value of having an advisory committee.
Lynn Jungworth is the other co-chair of the committee. She brings lessons from her home in Hayfork, California, a town of 2,200, in the Shasta Trinity National Forest. She says in the timber wars back home, both the industry and the conservation groups were powerful. When they fought it out, the communities got caught in the crossfire.
So while the conservation industry might stop a sale in order to harm industry, we're the people who lost our homes, lost our equipment, lost our jobs. So we kind of thought, well, you know, we need to get together and have a voice because this is a transition time. We have got to stop pitting conservation against economy and build a conservation-based economy.
Thorn Bay City Administrator Wayne Benner says even if the committee fails, the learning and perspective is valuable.
If nothing comes out of it, everybody goes back to where they've come from. They're going to take back a little different vision of how the different entities and agencies really look at managing resources.
The Tongass Advisory Committee plans to meet monthly until its work is complete. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The Anchorage Port Project is taking a new direction toward modernization and rehabilitation instead of expansion. KSKA's Ann Hillman explored the aging facility.
Underneath the wharf at the Port of Anchorage stand 1,400 hollow steel posts. The lower sections of the damp metal are covered in thick, reddish-brown corrosion caused by bacteria, silt, and salty water. Thick steel sleeves have been bolted around some of them to cover cracks and holes. The sleeves have started to corrode as well. Port engineer Todd Coles calls them Band-Aids.
You can spend 15 years fixing 100 piles a year, only to have the ones you started with starting to fail. These are not 75-year solutions. These are 10 to 15-year solutions. So you invest as much upfront cost to get much less return on your investment.
So now the Municipality of Anchorage and CH2M Hill are designing three possible long-term solutions to the problem. The basic idea is to use steel piles filled with reinforced concrete. If the steel corrodes away in 20 years, the concrete keeps standing. Port managers want to replace two of the four aging terminals, replace aging cranes and other infrastructure with modern equipment, and make the port more earthquake-proof. They will not add any more berths. Cole says construction will change the flow of work for many of the companies that offload goods at the port.
We have to move these customers south to be able to make that happen because we're planning a wholesale demolition and reconstruction.
The project is a far cry from the failed expansion started in 2006 that resulted in $312 million in expenditures, piles of unused materials, and multiple lawsuits. Cole says this time, they took a different approach to the project.
I think what we did better this time is really involve our primary stakeholders in the and kind of kicking the tires on the concept.
They held a week-long meeting with engineers, pilots, and port users in late August. The designs will be developed enough to estimate their price tags, layouts, and potential risks. They'll be presented to the municipality in early November. 4 million tons of goods pass through the port each year, as well as a majority of all of the cement and jet fuel used in the state. Cole says the port projects have not interrupted any port activities to date. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Sea Life Center cares for its two-month-old Stellar Sea Lion pup.
We weighed him about a week after he was born, and so he's more than doubled in size. He's doing really well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Alaska has ranked among the top 10 states in several categories of illegal drug use in recent years. Last week, participants at the Reclaim Alaska 2014 Substance Abuse Summit, hosted by the Aleutian-Pribilof Islands Association, talked about the problem and ways to address it. Participants were also cautioned that civil rights must not be trampled in the process of stemming the flow of illegal drugs. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Drug and alcohol abuse can be more visible in small towns where people can readily see effects such as violence, unintended injury and death, and drug-related burglaries and robberies. Brenda Wilson of King Cove is a member of the Aleutians East Borough Assembly. She says it's easy to think somebody should be doing something, but harder to be that somebody.
3 years ago when I was really proactive, I had someone tell me, Brenda, you got to shut up, you're going to end up with a bullet between the eyes. And I stepped back. And this was a close relative of mine who told me that, and it really scared me. So, but I've got grandkids now. And I want my grandkids to grow up in an environment that's safe and healthy and culturally good for them. And we need everybody's help in this room. And it starts with somebody. And that somebody is all of us.
People at the summit asked how they can help stem the flow of cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and methamphetamines into their communities. They were told telephone tip lines work best if people provide enough information so police can verify details and prove probable cause to conduct a search. But when it came to using police dogs to search luggage coming into a town, Matt Widmer, an assistant public defender for the state, urged caution.
There's no constitutional right for protection of a community. Victims have constitutional rights under the Alaska Constitution, but they don't have it under the federal Constitution. Only an accused has constitutional rights under the federal Constitution, and as a country, we've decided to go that way for a number of reasons that I think are very good. I think we don't want to be a society that lives in fear of government overreach.
State Department of Public Safety Commissioner Gary Folger agrees. He quoted Summit keynote speaker Sophia Stichler of St. Paul.
Ms. Stichler this morning said something that kind of struck a chord with me. When you fight the monster, don't become the monster. You know, years ago, I had the opportunity to listen to some Holocaust survivors and how the Third Reich came into power. And it's a fine line when you go up against, you know, right from wrong. And I look at myself as a person that, you know, helps guard that line.
Another participant asked about the legal line for companies that require employees to consent to searches. Alaska State Trooper Lieutenant Rex Leith says employers have more leeway than they may know.
We work with the companies there locally, and they have much more authority than they realize they have. We can't ask them to do things because then they become an agent of ours and then our rules apply to them. But as a company, they can do that. And the rules are different for you. I talk to your corporate lawyers for that. But if you find something during a legal search that you're doing and you call us, then we could possibly take action.
Other sessions will focus on treatment, rehabilitation, and community planning. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The summer tourism season is winding down, with even the hardiest travelers thinking about heading south. Alaska regularly attracts adventurous people from around the world, including motorcycle tourists. KUAC's Dan Bross met up with two German visitors on extended motorcycle journeys.
Matthias Kanura starts up his tired 1999 BMW motorcycle.
Her name is Betsy.
The 26-year-old has spent the last 2.5 years riding Betsy 60,000 miles around the Americas.
I've been through plus 50 degrees Celsius in Death Valley and minus 30 degrees Celsius in Regina, all with that motorcycle. And she did everything. There's snow, ice, gravel, sand, everything.
Kanura's Beamer isn't pretty, but he talks up the simple bike's durability. That said, it's a lot higher tech than the motorcycle of a fellow German traveler.
My motorcycle, I call Tuff Tuff.
Kai Bagus's ride is a vintage 50cc powered motor trike from the former German Democratic Republic.
It's just a motorcycle for go a little bit around the town for shopping or and not for go around the world. But it works.
In recent years, Bagus has ridden his three-wheeled Tuff Tuff across Europe and Russia and now North America.
All with this little motorcycle, yes.
Bagus's trike has motored him around the world at an average speed of under 30 miles per hour. But the slow, funky rig facilitates the 49-year-old's travel style he describes as all about meeting people.
It's very easy to have contacts because all the people come to you and ask, hey man, what's going on with this? And this is so nice.
Bagus and Kanura first crossed paths in Whitehorse and have been leapfrogging ever since.
It's kind of funny. I probably ride twice as fast as Kai does, but I take all the detours and go everywhere, and Kai just rides straight.
Both riders travel on the cheap. Even with motorcycle repairs, Kanura estimates his monthly costs average about $1,000. The adventurers rested up while in Fairbanks at the home of new friend and fellow motorcycle touring enthusiast Ramey Wood.
I kind of consider this an embassy. When you're away from home, you need a place where you feel safe and comfortable and you can get the help that you need and so forth. So that's what we do.
And this is here a very nice place. Yeah.
Generous human spirit has kept Bagus and Kanura going even when their journeys are dampened by poor weather, crashes, and breakdowns. The two expect to continue crossing paths as they head south and their adventures wrap up this fall. It'll only be a temporary break from the road. Both plan to fly home to Germany, work, and save up money for another big trip. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A very special Stellar Sea Lion pup got a name last week at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. He's the result of a special breeding and research program looking into the decline of the endangered marine mammals in the state. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The two-month-old pup is named Forrest.
He's very special. He is only the second Stellar Sea Lion to be born in a Zoo aquarium in over 25 years.
Derek Woody is the mammal curator for the center. He says it's unusual to see Stellar Sea Lions in zoos and aquariums in the U.S. and Canada. There are only 4 places around the country that house them, and the Sea Life Center is the only breeding facility. Woody says the center partners with organizations both domestically and internationally for its breeding and research program.
We had a successful pup last year for the first time. Her name is Ellie, and female, and she's now 1 year and looking really well. And then her younger brother was born July 20th of this year, first male, and that's very, very important. There's very few males in the population. So he will be carrying on the torch further on in life. So we're very excited to have him here.
According to the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, there are two distinct stellar sea lion populations, eastern and western. The eastern sea lions inhabit the west coast of the U.S., from California to Oregon and Washington, and up the Alaska Panhandle and Canadian coast. The western animals inhabit the Gulf of Alaska, up the western coast of the state, and out the Aleutians to Russia and Japan. Stellar sea lions were first listed as endangered species in 1990, before the two populations were recognized as distinct in 1997. The eastern population was then taken off the endangered species list in 2013.
But the western stock of animals is still listed, and we're finding that younger animals between the ages of 2, 3, and 4 are disappearing. So we're trying to learn what's going on, what's happening with them.
According to California's Marine Mammal Center, the western population declined about 75% between 1976 and 1990, and another 40% between 1991 and 2000, with the most significant drops happening in the eastern Aleutians and western Gulf Coast. NOAA lists many threats to the stellar sea lion population that are all too familiar in Alaska. They include ship strikes, water pollutants, degradation of habitat, oil and gas exploration, interaction with fisheries, and competition for food sources in critical habitat. And food sources are key when you look at the animal's reproductive cycle. Woody says that's the focus of some of the research going on at the Sea Life Center.
And also how much energy it takes for a mother to be able to not only reproduce, but be able to feed that young as well. Because these guys breed, I think it's a little different than what most people think. They breed and then they give birth 1 year later. And then 10 days after they give birth, they will breed again.
That means the mother is expending thousands of calories nursing the pup while pregnant with another. Woody says understanding what it takes to keep females reproducing healthily could be key to strengthening the populations.
Here at the Sea Life Center, we're able to track how many calories are going in so that she can feed not only the newborn, but also the growing pup in her as well.
And Forrest is taking advantage of all those calories. He's a nice, fat, healthy pup, weighing in at about 80 pounds in just 2 months. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
As winter approaches, many animals are migrating south, but there's one creature that scientists say in recent years has started to remain in the high Arctic in the winter. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, red foxes have not only expanded their habitat into the far north, the charismatic bushy-tailed mammal is out-competing the native Arctic fox and causing problems at oil field dumpsters in Prudhoe Bay.
Wildlife biologist Garrett Savory says the red fox is indeed wily, curious, and sly.
It's a jack of all foxes. It's highly adaptable. It's been found in many habitats, anywhere from wilderness conditions like the boreal forest around here in interior Alaska, all the way to living in suburban London.
Savory studied the red fox as part of his master's thesis at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctic Biology. He says red foxes didn't move from the northern foothills of the Brooks Range to Prudhoe Bay until the 1980s. In the last decade, he says red foxes have started to overwinter there. Now they're beginning to outnumber their smaller, shyer counterpart, the Arctic fox.
The one aspect that has changed since the 20th century is there's been more people moving into Arctic, mostly for resource development. In Alaska, oil.
Savory says scientists believe red foxes have been able to utilize the Dalton Highway as a travel corridor to move north. He says they may have scavenged on garbage left by travelers.
And then also their hunters use the Dalton Highway to access to hunt caribou, and they could possibly scavenge off the gut piles from caribou hunters. In addition, there's the Sag River, which runs parallel to the Dalton Highway, and that's an excellent corridor as well. It goes right straight from the Brooks Range to Prudhoe Bay.
But how foxes managed to survive the frigid Arctic winter remained a mystery to Savory. So he decided to capture both red and Arctic foxes for tissue samples to find out more about their diets. A stable isotope analysis shows both species rely heavily on human sources of food in the winter. Landfills and dumpsters at Prudhoe Bay are made to keep large animals like bears out. But Savory says a small sly fox can squeeze under fences and through holes in dumpsters.
One day in Prudhoe Bay in early May, which is still winter up there, mind you, I counted 7 red foxes all within a short period of time. And it's just casually looking. It wasn't looking hard. So they can really, they really know like the landfill is a good food source. And they know the dumpsters are good food sources. You see tracks all around there.
Savory's study shows human food waste makes up nearly 49% of the red fox diet on the North Slope in the winter. In Arctic foxes, 39% of their diet can be attributed to anthropogenic sources. Data also show the Arctic fox has a more varied summer diet, relying on a combination of small animals and bird eggs, whereas the red fox depends almost entirely on lemmings for food in the summertime.
You know, the red fox is less efficient with the food. I mean, the Arctic fox picture is like a little Prius, and the red fox picture is a big old Cadillac. It just needs more fuel to get by.
The presence of the red fox could have dire consequences for animals like the lemming, but it could also cause problems for oil field workers' safety.
Rabies is a naturally occurring disease in the Arctic fox population. And with red foxes moving in to these areas, it's not known how they will spread rabies. And this is really important in terms of oil field worker safety.
But Savory says there's a solution.
It'd be great if they could reduce garbage access to prevent wildlife from accessing it. And they can either do this by keeping the garbage inside until they're ready to take it to the landfill or even incinerating it. Not only red foxes and Arctic foxes are using it, but there's other glaucous gulls and ravens are also accessing this as well.
Savory's research was published in the Journal of Canadian Zoology last spring. Funding came from the National Science Foundation, UAF's Institute of Arctic Biology, BP Exploration Incorporated, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ann Hillman and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Dan Brass and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.